Thanks for joining us on WPR News today. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking to begin the show with Anton Troyer about his latest book. It's titled Where Wolves Don't Die. And we're also going to cover some current events going on in Indian country with Anton. He's a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. He's authored many books, very active in Ojibwe language revitalization. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about Native Americans? How has learning about different cultures helped you understand people with different backgrounds? If you are Native American, what do you wish non-Native people would understand, maybe? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Anton Troyer, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Been a while since we last visited, and you have another book out. So let's talk about that first. It's called Where Wolves Don't Die. And it's a young reader's book. Give us an overview of the book.
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that. You know, as you mentioned, I've published many books, but this is my first work of fiction. And it's the story of Ezra Cloud. He's a 15-year-old Native kid. The journey begins in the Twin Cities, and it's both a thriller, a whodunit, and also kind of a tender coming-of-age story. Early in the book, he's embroiled in a major investigation, and his family kind of believing his innocence, but also trying to protect him from himself and being misunderstood, sends him to run a trap line with his grandfather in the Canadian wilderness. And through it all, Ezra's, you know, grappling with loss and the kind of drama unfolding in the story. And as he's kind of looking for clues to a murder, he's also finding himself. It was a lot of fun to do it.
It must have been. You sort of aimed it at younger readers. Why did you make that choice?
Well, you know, the young adult genre includes Harry Potter and things like that. I think, you know, the transition from childhood to adulthood is really an excellent entry point to look at, you know, emotional change, the arc for character development. It was just the perfect setting for thinking about what does it mean to come of age? What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be indigenous in this modern world? Also, you know, I'm at the stage now in my life, my wife and I, we have 9 children. We have 6 out the door, 3 to go. They're all in the teenager phase. And so I've been thinking a lot about, you know, parenting and about this transition. You know, it's terrifying being a parent in this world. And you got one shot at it. The number one goal is do not mess your kids up, but you don't get any do-overs. And there's so much that can trip a kid up. But there's also so much that can help them, you know, develop a beautiful life. And I think in part too, you know, I have been frustrated with Indigenous literature broadly. For starters, until the past 20 years, most of it was written by non-Native people who hadn't even talked to one of us. It would not give you authentic Native perspectives and voices and experiences. It was more like the white man's Indian, and the imaginings were usually stories of trauma and tragedy and, you know, oh, those poor people. And you read the book and you're either thinking, you know, to heck with them, shoot them all like John Wayne, or, you know, let's go hug an Indian. And, you know, for me, I always found it so ironic because I speak Ojibwe. All of my kids love to hunt, fish, gather. We do these sorts of activities. Even though we're in a modern world, we, you know, keep our culture going. And so I wanted to do something kind of different. And over the past 20 years, we've had some really great Native lit. I mean, Louise Erdrich just won a Pulitzer Prize. There's been so many great things happening. But even a lot of the indigenous authored indigenous literature are still focused on trauma and tragedy and characters who lament the culture they never had because of residential boarding schools. And I wanted to provide a window into the living, beautiful culture that is still there, to still have a character who's like navigating the things, the stories crackling with tension all the way through, and it keeps you engaged. But also, that wouldn't be an imagining of Native culture, but a window into what it actually can look like and deliver for someone.
Yeah, it's very well said. Another one of your books was selected for Minnesota's One Read program, the Young Readers Edition of your book, Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. Maybe first, what's the One Read program?
You know, there have been some interesting things that were happening in Minnesota. The Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux community had a major initiative to kind of transform the representation of Native people in education across the state. They invested about $5 million, most of which was for teacher trainings, publishing resources, things like that. But they did do a one read and book buy of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. So we developed teacher guides for that, educator guides. They're up for free on my website and the Understand Native Minnesota website. And they gave away 10,000 copies to schools for classroom sets. It was, you know, they were claimed in 30 minutes. It was really popular. So the Minnesota Department of Education did another 10,000 copies. And then we had actually some, a private donor to a nonprofit funded a giveaway for the Where Wolves Don't Die book, again, another 10,000 copies. And so, you know, for those in Wisconsin who are listening, you know, we have Act 31, all Wisconsin educators are supposed to learn about, you know, Native people. There's some new threads in the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction's education standards around Native stuff. And so I think they'll find it very helpful that there are free educator guides for both Where Wolves Don't Die and Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask, so that people can pick it up and run with it in the classroom as well as their own reading pleasure.
Yeah. Well, Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask, that is a great book, a beloved book, I think. And you and I talked about it maybe 3 years ago on the show. And it's been very positively received. Why do you think readers have responded to it so positively?
Well, you know, I think a couple of things land well with that particular book. First of all, you know, we know that the world that our children will live in, you know, is a place we can only imagine, but we have to imagine it'll be a diverse place. I think a lot of people want to get along. I think a lot of people want more than a sugar-coated version of Chris Columbus and the first Thanksgiving. And this book, you know, delivers on a wide variety of topics and provides perspective on that. But I think, you know, when we have some of the tougher topics, you know, race relations in America, politics, things like that, it gets very testy and angry. And I think the tone for the work is very positive and inviting and inclusive, even though it doesn't flinch away from or avoid, you know, tough or controversial topics. So I think it provides a way to navigate those. You know, I initially was thinking about non-Native people, but you know, I've been really heartened by its response in the Native community, too, because all of us get bombarded with the same kinds of questions. And I realized that, you know, my mother, she had a law degree and became a tribal judge. But when I finished high school, I would have been hard-pressed to explain tribal sovereignty to somebody. I got the same education everyone else in America got. And, you know, and so, like, there were some things I knew, like what it was like living in my body in a Native community, you know, but some of the other things I had to hunt for answers. In many ways, honestly, I'm still hunting. And so I'm also like not claiming, in spite of the cute title, not claiming more voice than I have. Like, there are lots of things I don't know. I shoot straight. When there are things that are a matter of perspective, I'll say, hey, natives, we don't all agree any more than white people would agree about abortion or anything else. So, you know, here are some of the issues, how they play out, some of the, you know, things that are unique to Native communities, and here's what I think. And I think that just kind of helps people identify, you know, no one's trying to sell you something. We're just trying to understand each other.
Yeah, I love that book. There were moments in it when I laughed out loud, but I remember I learned an awful lot from your book. Well, I wanted to deal with some issues that have come up, some positive things that have come up. For example, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwa returned 12,000 acres of land. I want to get to that, but Jean in Fort Atkinson has another issue she wanted to bring up and just see if you have a comment on it. Jean, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's very interesting. So far, I'm definitely going to get that book and read it. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on what's going up and on it with the Bad River Tribe in northern Wisconsin.
Oh, yes.
The Land 5 issue, among other things?
Yeah, there are things that are happening in Bad River right now. So I assume you're talking about the issue with regard to the pipeline that across the reservation. Okay. Yeah, so, you know, Enbridge operates a pipeline that goes through the reservation. In recent years, there's been a bigger protest against that particular pipeline and some jurisdictional issues that have popped up. So, you know, the terms for the agreement, you know, cover certain tracts of tribal land, and the status of some pieces of land that the pipeline goes across have shifted back into tribal trust land, and the tribe is saying, we don't want this pipeline on our land, reroute it. And, you know, Enbridge has been trying to negotiate with the tribe, with probably limited effect in recent years, to get permission to keep their pipeline where it transects parcels that they did not have, that they no longer have permission to have it on. I right now, you know, it's kind of like my lawyers talk to your lawyers as far as the negotiations around it. There's a new documentary that covers this called Bad River, and it had limited theatrical release, but will be, has a streaming deal with Peacock. It should be coming out soon that discusses this. The issues are really pretty complex, but I think, you know, for a company like Enbridge, you know, back even when they were first setting up pipelines in the 40s and 50s, those guys did not do a favor to anybody working at Enbridge today. They, at that time, thought, hey, let's route this thing through the, you know, easiest route we can find politically and economically, rather than what made the most environmental sense or what respected tribal sovereignty. And today, you know, tribes are exercising their sovereignty and drawing their boundaries and standing up for their rights with much greater effect. So it's, I don't have a crystal ball that'll be able to tell you how that will be resolved. I do think that it's possible it'll be rerouted to avoid the reservation. I think it is extremely unlikely that Line 5 would be abandoned. Both because the rest of the pipeline's got its easements in place and there's so much money on the table.
Yeah. Gene, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Anton Troyer, our guest today, professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University, author of many books, with him to talk about a bit about his books, but also to talk about other issues in the Native community. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Anton Troyer, professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Quick note, coming at noon today, we'll learn about evidence of ancient people in the Driftless area and how the archaeological sites are being preserved today. But that's at noon. Right now, taking a look at native issues. John in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I hope this isn't too far off topic, but with respect to the Bad River pipeline, or the Enbridge pipeline, you mentioned that you didn't think that it would close because there was so much money on the table. And while listening to the best of our knowledge, the indigenous folks being interviewed there were very adamant that they didn't care how much money was being offered. They wanted it gone. Can you expand on why you think that they still might reconsider that?
Oh, I don't think the tribe is likely to reconsider their position. And I don't think tribal people, you know, you might find a variety of opinions amongst tribal people, but I don't think that is going to, you know, dramatically change in the near future either. I just, you know, in my experience, when it comes to mines, pipelines, and other things, the corporations have so much money on the table, like, and so much at stake, and our political process has politicians so beholden to corporate interests that it is most likely, most of the time, that most of the mines and pipelines will get pushed through over the objections of citizens, you know, social activism, and even tribes. That doesn't happen all the time. You know, Enbridge had to abandon its proposed Sandpiper pipeline in Minnesota, in part because the delays over tribal protest and objection were so substantive and effective. So I do think there is the possibility for effect. And I do think that from what I have seen and the people I've talked to, and I mean, I am constantly in Minnesota and Wisconsin working in tribal communities. I don't think the tribe is going to change its position. And so I think Enbridge will be working on a way to reroute that pipeline around the reservation. But I don't think they would just shut off the pipeline and say, we're not going to do pipelines in Wisconsin anymore. They'll just find a different way to get it done.
Yeah.
So their position is there, you know, there are many ways to skin a cat. We'll find a different way if this one doesn't work.
John,
that's all I meant.
Yeah, John, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, I mentioned Leech Lake. The Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe were returned 12,000 acres of land. And I think that land was originally, well, there's probably an interesting history on it. I think the Bureau of Indian Affairs seized it back in the 1940s.
Yeah, it is an interesting and complex history. So, you know, the Leech Lake Reservation, which is one of the Ojibwe reservations in northern Minnesota, and this is, by the way, where my family comes from. My relatives have been buried in the Bena Cemetery in the center of the Leech Lake Reservation longer than America's been a country. So the Leech Lake Reservation encompasses at least parts of the three of the largest lakes in Minnesota. It's, you know, kind of oddly shaped, but roughly 40 miles by 40 miles. And 85% of the Leech Lake Reservation was incorporated into an entity called the Chippewa National Forest. And it kind of was a piecemeal process, started in 1908, and then further changes made in 1928. But when that happened, it essentially took 85% of the reservation out of tribal control, especially with regard to natural resources. Sometimes it surprises people, but there's a very big difference between a national forest and a national park. So national parks are usually protected from development and clear cutting and things like that, but national forests are routinely clear cut for financial benefit, and the monies go to the U.S. federal government. And so it was always frustrating for the tribe that, you know, they have so many, they're about 10,000 tribal members, and a lot of people, you know, rely upon the woods for everything from not just recreational hunting, but subsistence hunting and fishing and things like that. And so there's been a long effort by the tribe to return the Chippewa National Forest to tribal conservatorship. Of course, by this point in time, there are lots of non-native people who also hunt in the Chippewa National Forest, and there were all kinds of concerns. This is an example of a recent push in many areas that is sometimes called land back as a restorative justice area. It's an effort to return lands to tribal control, even to have tribes steward public goods on behalf of everybody. And so a section of the Chippewa National Forest, 12,000 acre parcel, was recently, they just did the formalization very recently to the tribe. It's not the entire Chippewa National Forest, but so far it's been very positive. Some of the things that when a lot of people hear land back, they start getting scared, like, what? They want all the white people to move back to Europe? Are they going to take it all? You know, are they coming for my house? Are those natives will never pay taxes on it? You know, and those kind of things, all of which are misunderstandings. So maybe I'll briefly address them. First of all, if land is in public holding, like it's held by the federal or state government, no one has ever paid taxes on it. So it's not affecting the tax base. Second of all, you know, it's not to deny anyone else use or access, you know, necessarily. It is to switch who is the conservator for public goods. So at Leech Lake, you know, the tribe will hold the Chippewa, this section of the Chippewa National Forest, and they will actually put a moratorium on further clear cutting so that the maple groves can mature and be used for tribal harvesters, so that any remaining old growth sections can be preserved for those who use medicines. And actually, even the white guys who hunt there will have a healthier forest to hunt in, and everyone will benefit from this particular action. Each one needs to be evaluated on its own terms, and some are very big and some are very small. You know, I'm on the governing board for the Minnesota State Historical Society, and we had a couple smaller parcel repatriations to Dakota communities that were very well received by both Native and non-Native folks. So I think there are ways to do this as an effort. These are small steps in a much larger effort to rehabilitate relationships and explore what justice looks like.
Yeah, yeah. There've got to be, maybe you could comment a bit on the legal and the logistical challenges that are associated with the land bank movement.
Yes, it can be very complex. I was inside the room on all the process for what Minnesota Historical Society did. Like, there are state statutes in Minnesota that you cannot reduce the net acreage held in state conservatorship. So by repatriating a section to the tribe, they actually had to take another section in a different part of the state into state conservatorship, and had multiple agencies, the Department of Natural Resources and others, involved in this action. So it wasn't as simple as, you know, we're signing over the deed to the tribe. So it can be complex, and there are many different considerations. So environmental, legal, you know, social, and the context is different in different places. But I do think, you know, it's often misunderstood, but can be a really positive way to take some steps down the reconciliation and justice journey.
Yeah. Is it much different from, I mean, the land bank back program? Is it different from previous land reclamation efforts? Much?
I think really land back is more a broadening of previous efforts. You know, there have been a number of court cases, you know, the Indian Claims Commission and other things that we're trying to address. I think what everybody of every political persuasion would admit was just a swindling and horrible mistreatment of tribes in many different areas. But the problem is, like, our court system usually, you know, even when a tribe wins, they will say, yes, the tribe was defrauded. The government did not act in good faith. They did not do what they said they were going to do. and therefore we will write you a check. And usually there's like a monetary settlement rather than the return of land. There's really not much of a precedent for that. And then if the tribe cashes the check, they've just authorized whoever the current landholder is and denied any further possibility of them actually getting the land back. So famously, the Black Hills land case for the Lakota, it was a pretty large financial settlement, and the tribe refused to receive or spend the money. So it's still held by the U.S. government, you know, the funds, collecting interest, you know, every year, and they still won't take the money. And those are very economically disadvantaged tribal communities. But on principle, they say, we really want the land, not the money.
Oh, man. Are there other areas in Minnesota or Wisconsin where, or, you know, in the Midwest where land bank, I always want to say land bank, it's land back, has been successful or at least in the process of trying to reach agreement on some land back?
Oh, yes, many others. You know, in the American, you know, West, there have been proposals to actually have tribes steward even some national park lands. There have been numerous, much smaller repatriations. Some municipalities have authorized a voluntary land tax, where essentially there's a little, like when you do your property taxes, there's an option to click, yes, I want to pay a voluntary land tax, and then that tax goes to the tribe rather than to the municipality. But it's voluntary rather than compulsory. But there have been a number of experiments with different ways to work at restorative justice. In both the United States and Canada, there have been numerous court cases. Canada actually had a really big one. The Huron-Robinson Treaty was a $10 billion financial settlement, and the First Nations there are talking about tithing a huge portion of the money, like $250 million, for language revitalization as a restorative justice measure rather than just, you know, paying out money to tribal members. So there are lots of interesting things happening, you know, thinking about what would justice look like. And, you know, honestly, when you look big picture at these things, for any of the many injustices humans have visited upon each other throughout time, there's no way to go back in time. There's no way to, like, undo the Nazi Holocaust or, you know, things like this. You know, but there are ways to go forward. And I think some of the things that provide meaningful redress include major education and public awareness efforts, where there have been profound economic, you know, or social impacts on a population that was oppressed. I think there are public actions we can take that will, you know, provide a way to address that. So some places have, you know, put money into scholarships for people from disadvantaged groups or things like that. But I think this land back effort is one, you know, tribes are in a different position than a lot of other groups who've experienced oppression in America in that there are distinct political entities, you know, Native nations that predate the United States. So there's a different vehicle for even receiving, you know, land or something like that. So I think some of the issues, you know, are distinct with natives and native communities and tribes, but that doesn't mean anything will ever make it perfectly right. And in many ways, getting to forgiveness is not saying that something bad that happened is okay. It says this happened, we can't change it. And I choose, you know, now to accept that and go forward. And going forward can be renewing the relationship, you know, between various parties or releasing the relationship. And I think some of our big public debates about statues or art in public spaces and things like that are an effort to renegotiate what things should we put, you know, give primacy of place in our shared spaces?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned languages and language, and of course, that one of your areas of deep interest is native languages. And give us a sense of the number and complexity of native languages in the Americas.
Oh, you know, first of all, there are about 7,000 languages on planet Earth right now, of which 2,500 are spoken only by elders. So we're seeing big language loss. Like, people are aware that we're having climate change and, you know, extinction issues with different species, but this is happening with bodies of knowledge and human ways of knowing. Within the Americas, we actually have, you know, over 500 languages originally in what's now Canada and the United States. And then when you look at Mexico and South America, there are many, many more than that. Many of these languages are endangered. Like in the U.S. and Canada, we've gone from 500 languages originally spoken. Right now, depending on what study you're looking at, maybe 163 are still spoken. Of those, only about 20 are spoken by significant numbers of children. So, you know, if we're going to keep those things going, then it really depends on the depth and breadth of our interventions around them right now.
I think someone might, not me, but someone might ask, why, what's the importance of keeping those languages?
Oh, yes. It, you know, it is a common question, and it's not a mean-spirited one, but it's easy to privilege a body of knowledge or way of knowing that we're familiar with. Like, we can solve a lot of our problems with science, but we don't want to abandon all the other ways of knowing. You can also solve some really big problems with art and music. Like, it's one of the most common unifying things that all humans can agree about. But we can't solve all of our problems with art and music. You know, and embedded in each language are unique ways of looking at the world and unique ways of solving problems. You know, we've been doing colonization for a long time. Colonization is taking one language, culture, and religion and using it to supplant the others. It's about erasure and uses violence to do it. But when we solve all of our problems with violence, it makes a bunch of other problems. Now, why would we think that all of the problems created by the colonial way of solving problems can be solved by the colonial way of solving problems?
Yeah.
And they can't. They can't. And so we're going to need all of the different ideas and perspectives and ways of looking at the world. And I think, honestly, democracy in the history of humans, democracy is brand new. It's an experiment. And having democracy for a very large country is very new. You know, Plato, who wrote The Republic, which is one of the foundational texts, you know, the idea of democracy and voting and representative government, he thought it would work well if your country was comprised of 25,000 people. You know, we got 330 million people in America. And I think democracy will work if it can support diversity. And I think democracy will fail if it cannot. So imagine for our kids, you know, for most of the lives of most of the kids in America, there will not be, you know, a majority racial group. Everybody will have a minority experience. And, you know, I'm not saying it should be this way, but, like, there will also, we're on the way to, like, not even having a majority religious group in America. Every religious group will have a minority experience. And so if we exert our political efforts to privileging one religion, language, culture, or race over all the others, then everyone who's in the benefiting class will be in the victim class. Everybody will be hurt by that. And everybody's dehumanized when anyone's dehumanized. So like it or not, we're going to have to figure out how to get along, to do things together, and to support one another's different cultures, religions, races, and languages. And if we can figure out how to do that, democracy will thrive. Hmm. And if not, one's going to have an oppression experience. So there's more at stake than just another pretty bird singing in the forest. Although we love all the languages and we want all the pretty birds to be able to sing in the forest. But there's more. So, an indigenous language revitalization effort is about more than just that particular group and their right or wish to have their language. It's about how we support and respect one another.
Anton Troyer, professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. It's great to have him with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Larry Mealer. Coming up tomorrow on Garden Talk, an extension educator returns to check in on how your plants are doing midway through the growing season. And then at 12:30, Melinda Myers returns to talk about new low-maintenance flowering shrubs that have been added to the Energy Park at State Fair, and talk about the appearances. She'll be making many appearances at State Fair. Right now, speaking on Indian issues with Anton Troyer, professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. Great to have him with us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Let's take a call from Karen in Appleton. Karen, hello.
Hi there. As a young woman, I went to Bemidji when it was still a college, not a university. And I had the good opportunity to take a couple of classes by Gerald Visner, who is a Native American specialist. And I've always had an interest. We were just in Canada, and their programs for the First Nation people are so far ahead of what we're doing in the United States. And I wish that we would do more.
Karen, thanks. A comment, Anton?
Oh, I really agree with Karen. Thanks for the Bemidji State connection. Go Beavers. And yes, one of the things that our education systems can do is really pull us together and provide opportunities, not just for Native people to learn about themselves, but for everybody to learn about everybody. And, Canada had a major truth and reconciliation effort, starting really a little over a couple decades ago. There are a number of calls to action, and they've, exercised on a few of them. They still have plenty of work to do in Canada. The circumstances are kind of different, but there has been, new action at colleges and universities in Canada to build up Indigenous studies, to do more language revitalization work. I think there's been social change too. Wab Tanu was elected premier of Manitoba. So he's the top elected official in the province of Manitoba, well supported by, First Nations people, Métis communities, and white folk and everybody else. So, all of that is very positive. But there's some really distinct, issues in Canada. I've never met a First Nations person who said everything's great. I think there are still challenges with, access to economic opportunity, social and educational advancement, many different things, and sovereignty is still a major, major issue. But there's certainly, you're right, Karen, there's the mobilization of resources. It's heartening. Some of the things that are different in the United States is that, sovereignty is really configured as pre-existing the United States of America, existing in spite of all of the mistreatments of Native people throughout America's history, and it's inherent. So even with the, much more conservative Supreme Court in the United States, tribes have won their most recent major cases that have affirmed the Indian Child Welfare Act and the status of tribal lands within reservations. because of this strong legal underpinning. So that is something that has really buoyed sovereignty of tribes in America that they're still, you know, struggling to sort out in Canada. So different in both places, but I'd certainly agree with, the observation that there's a lot more happening on the education front in Canada in recent years.
Yeah. Karen, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. Language, let's go back to language a bit, because I know you have worked long and hard to bring the Ojibwe language back. And maybe you could talk about your efforts.
Oh, you know, no one does work like that alone. Almost all of the major efforts, have been team things. I'll share one brief story just to give a sense for something that happened recently. So the neighboring Ojibwe reservation, Mille Lacs, in central Minnesota, gave me a call. This was maybe a year or so before the pandemic. And they said, hey, we have some monies, there are overages from grants and other things, and we would like to do something meaningful about language revitalization. I said, well, how much money are you talking about? They said, it's about $14 million. So after nearly spitting my teeth out, I started giving them a list of things. They had identified only 25 remaining fluent first speakers in all of Mille Lacs. There's 6,000 tribal members. And I said, they're all elders over 70. You're not going to send them all back to college to get degrees and come teach for you for another 30 years. We have to do something else. I said, why don't we develop Rosetta Stone for Ojibwe? That's a language learning tool, kind of like Duolingo or Babbel. I said, let's develop some new books so we can work on a literacy initiative in the language. And they looked at me and they said, well, let's do all of it. And we started working. We paired up a transcriber with each of their fluent speakers. We had to teach people how to work through the pandemic. So we sent a grandkid and a computer to each elder's house. And it was amazing how productive those elders were. We published the first 5 books, had partnerships with our historical society to publish them. Rosetta Stone came out. And they have a major multi-year development. There were lots of things to think about. We worked the contract so the tribe would retain copyright of everything, could repurpose it. They made it free for tribal members and a nominal fee of $25 for everybody else. And even with that, they will recuperate their entire investment over the life of the project. And we had tragedies too, the pandemic. 6 of those 25 elders passed away. That was 20% of the fluent speakers in Mille Lacs. And when it was finally safe to come together and celebrate, Joe Naquanabe, he's one of the elders there. He's a ceremonial drum chief and was working on all these projects with us. And we asked him to speak. And, his sister had died from COVID, and his brother had COVID and had heart complications and passed away during the pandemic. And I thought he would just say, this is the toughest time. And he kind of floored me when he said, we've been through a lot. We've been through a lot the past few years, and we've been through a lot the past few hundred years. But I have to say, seeing all of these young people coming around, seeing what we've been able to build, knowing that our elders will be teaching people our language for hundreds of years to come, I have to say that this was the happiest time of my life.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
It kind of floored me, So it was a reminder that doing this kind of work, yes, it is healing for young people who want to learn our language and culture, but it is healing for our elders, too, who want to keep it going even after they're gone.
Wow. And it sounds as though there, even though it's just been a few years, there's been some really good success there.
Yeah, it's humans, right? Like we have things that are awesome, we have things that are troubling, and they're all wrapped up in the same, fry bread taco, so to speak. So, I think one of the things that has happened in America is most of us, like 87% of the educational standards that even mention Native people, it's all stuff from before 1900. It's stories of tragedy and trauma. I find, especially when I go to the American South or the East Coast, where a lot of the natives were moved off to Oklahoma and stuff like that. I've even had people say, it's a shame they killed all the Indians. And I'm telling them, hold on a minute, I'm feeling pretty good today. And then they're like, oh, yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point. Like, it's not even on the radar screen. And so, you know, I think that we've just been conditioned to think of trauma and tragedy. And really, it's one of the things I was trying to do, and I think, you know, succeeding at with regard to Where Wolves Don't Die, my new book, which is a young adult fiction work, is that, you know, we're going to hold up something that's not just trauma and tragedy. And we're going to talk about, you know, how people can deal with the things and get to a healthier, more positive place. I have a lot of hope for where we go in Indian country.
Yeah. We're starting to run out of time here, but a good email, I think, from Francis. Could you please address the type of language we white people use around Native Americans? Francis thinks we should address Native people as First Nation people instead of Indians, which has a lot of racial connotations.
Oh, yeah. So it's a great question, like what terminology should we use, Indian, American Indian, Aboriginal, Indigenous, First Nation person or what? Unfortunately, this is not a settled debate, just like the, you know, Hispanic/Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latinx community's been going round and round, and the Black African-American community has also been going round and round. We have too. I agree with her. I would love to have this be settled for everybody's benefit, you know, something without too many syllables that everybody agrees on that speaks to our sovereignty. Maybe we could use Native Nations instead of First Nations if we need to distinguish from our Canadian brothers and sisters. But, you know, it's debated internally, and there are a lot of issues. Like, if you use Indigenous, it's broad and inclusive, but that can also be, you know, an Indigenous person from New Zealand who happens to be in America. If you need to clarify the legal status of Natives, that's part of why American Indian hasn't quite died yet. So, you know, what I usually tell people to do is just have the conversation with your Native stakeholders. If it's a K-12 school, your Native parent committee, if it's college, your Indigenous advisory council, ask them what you want to do, and you can follow their advice. And then that puts you in touch with your Native stakeholders and gets you a get out of getting beat up around the ears card. And we can all use one of those.
So what are you going to be teaching this coming year at Bemidji State, Anton?
Oh, I'm really excited for this coming school year. I teach a lot of language classes, but I do a lot of other stuff in Indigenous studies. Like a lot of state universities, we had a budget crisis in the previous year. Our Native programs, you know, came through that okay. But we kind of have to make our own luck as we go forward. So I'm really looking forward to that. And, you know, there's a lot of other really exciting work happening outside of the university, you know, in language revitalization, culture stuff, of course, the new books and so forth. So there is always a lot cooking in my universe.
I know that for sure. Anton, always a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope we get to do this again soon. Thank you so much.
I look forward to that. Thank you.
Anton Troyer, professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University, author of many books. His latest, and I've had a chance to read part of it, it's a good book. It's titled Where Wolves Don't Die. It's a young reader's book, but I'm young at heart. And you may be too, and you may want to take a look at it too. Where Wolves Don't Die by Anton Troyer. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. That's next. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News.